Well, we're glad to be with you here today. I figured out that having, I think, attended this now for 9 years, and I don't believe I've ever been able to speak to you at this Southeast Regional dance or prom, that I've had opportunity to speak to you before. And then I thought, maybe it was just, this is a rule of attrition. If you hang around long enough, they'll feel sorry for the guy and go, why don't you give it a shot, and we'll see how this works. So here is what I have prepared for you today. I'm going to ask, if you will, to start in Isaiah 40, verse 28. We're going to start in this one verse, and this verse is going to sound familiar if you've seen a movie that was aired not too long ago, within the last few years. Isaiah 40, verse 28 reads this way. Isaiah 40, verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Hacksaw Ridge. This verse is one of the first things you hear whenever you watch this movie. In fact, for probably many of us, it may have faded into oblivion, into the background, given the depiction that we see of what took place at Hacksaw Ridge during World War II. The movie was originally rated R, and I know that maybe some of us happen to have heard the story behind it and made an attempt to go see it. You may have been able to sit in the theater. The R rating generally is given to the movie because of its portrayal of war. More recently, it aired on the History Channel. I didn't get a chance to see it when it was in theaters. It passed by without getting there. And with a TV edit, there was a whole lot there that was difficult to stomach, but the storyline was still there, and a lot of the detail of the war still appeared. If you've not seen Hacksaw Ridge, the movie shows the gruesome events of what took place on Okinawa Island, Japan, in World War II. And even as we watch the movie and all it depicts, and it's horrific, probably I would contend about two-thirds of the movie is simply the battle of what you see. It's gruesome to watch. I spent a lot of time even in watching it finding myself, you know, recoiling at what took place there. It's what we watch even as we're there. We watch this entire battle play out. But we really focus on one individual. And if you've seen the movie, you know this. Private First Class Desmond T. Doss is really the focus of this movie. Doss happens to be a medic. And although he's like his fellow soldiers in many ways, he really differs with them in two basic ways. And they're linked to the fourth and the sixth commandment. If you don't know about Desmond Doss, Desmond Doss happened to have been a Seventh-day Adventist. And by background, even as we see him growing up around Lynchburg, Virginia, we see him keep the Sabbath day. We see him reflect these things in the movie even as he moves forward and deals with war. For this reason, we see him observe the Sabbath as best he can during the movie. And there's one pivotal point, if you've not seen it, where his entire unit recognizes this, and they won't go to war without him because of the way in which he views God. There's a second reason that Desmond Doss really gets attention for this movie, and it's simply because he refuses to bear arms. In fact, even when he goes to basic training, he won't even pick up a weapon. And we see this play out in the movie, where even his commanding officer requires, he tells them all to go over, if you've seen the movie, and pick up a rifle, and he won't go pick that rifle up. And they have this exchange there in front of his entire unit. And even as he talks about the fact that he won't go, based upon his belief in not killing others, his commanding officer, in essence, says, remember what he's doing here, because when you go into war, Desmond Doss will not be the guy who is on your side. Even as he goes through basic training, it's really hard to watch what happens because based upon his overseers and his unit, they start to really go at him. Many instances, because he won't pick up a rifle and because of his religious beliefs, they pull him out of bed in the middle of the night and they beat him mercilessly. And we see this in the movie to a point where even he rises at one point, someone coming in and turning the light on, and he's just black and blue all over his face. And then his commanding officer says, "What just happened here?" And Das says, "You know, I don't know what just happened." He denies everything that he goes through. He does this because even as he shares this, he's committed to serving his country, even though he believes he should never take a man's life. It's after basic training that his unit then is shipped to Okinawa, Japan, Okinawa Island. Like so many of those there in World War II who fought, you know, in that Asian contention or that Asian warfare, what they saw is, and here's the difficult part of the movie, can be described as nothing more than appalling. In fact, if you go back, I was looking at some of the quotes for those who endured that war. United States, USMC, corporate Eugene Sledge said this about what took place there. He said, "The only way I could bear the monstrous horror of battle was to look upward from the earthly reality surrounding us and repeat to myself, this must be a nightmare, and I would soon awake." It's in this battle that Doss's character really comes to the forefront, because he, as a medic, refuses to carry a rifle into battle. In fact, at one point, immediately before they go up the ridge, which happens to be a flat face of rock, which on the other side is all where the battle takes place, when they climb this backside of the ridge, one person tells him immediately before he goes up as a medic, because he's got an armband on and he's got a seal on his helmet that shows medic, says, "Take that thing off, because they're going to make target practice out of you, because they go after the medics here." And so you see him remove this even as he goes up, the only man who goes up the side of that mountain without a rifle. And when he gets into battle, as everyone does, we see nothing but killing and blood and unthinkable things that go on. One man after another, we see shot just to smithereens. And that's the part that's so difficult to watch. At a given point, despite the fact they can make advancement, or they do make advancements, they begin to be overrun by the Japanese army. Because the Japanese soldiers who come in in waves, are basically fighting to the death. They really don't care. And so they call a retreat, and after what looks like about half of his unit has been taken down, the rest of them drop back down the ridge, except Das does something strange. He doesn't descend. He stays there amidst the smoke and everything else, and he begins to save men. And his unit descends back down the mountain, and then they go back to a separate place where their camp is, and they leave two men there just to stand watch in case anyone else descends. And Das proceeds to go through all of these men who have been shot, find them, and bring them to the edge of the side of this mountain, and he figures out that he can take a rope and lower each one of them down. And it looks to be about a good 60 to 70 to 80 feet that he lowers them. And the first individual they see down, the guys don't even know what to do with it. They're looking up. There's a rope coming down. They don't have no idea what's going on. And they pull the soldier off, and they go put him over, and they look up, and there's another guy coming down. And even as we watch this play out, we see Das over and over for hours at a time, all the way through the night, continue to save man after man after man. Even as he does this, there's one point in the film, and if you've seen it again, it's going to stick with you. Even as he reaches a point of complete fatigue and his hands are bleeding, and they show a good picture of his hands from lowering these men from the rope, he says in an exhausted, muttery prayer, he says, "Just one more, God. Please help me get just one more." You know, even if we, as we watch this play out, his immediate commanding officer, having gone back with about half his unit, begins to see all of these guys who were shot up appear. When I say appear, they begin to be shipped in one after another. And he walks into one tent where they're trying to save these guys, and he's looking at about 10 to 15 beds of men he was convinced were all dead. And as he looks across them, he said, "Who's doing this?" And they all say, "Doss is still up on that ridge saving men." Doss that night wound up saving 75 men. And surprisingly, survived the whole. You know, even as we watch and see Doss and this his heroic acts, the one thing we're left with, because they share this at one point in the movie, is Doss has a complete faith in God. He's convinced that God's protecting him. He's convinced that God will help him save all of those men, even as he goes after them one after another, at times pulling, sadly, partial men to that side of that mountain and then lowering them down. You know, it goes to ask, even as we see this play out and we see the character of Desmond Doss, we throw this term around faith a lot. It's valuable for us to ask from time to time, what is faith? And today I'm going to ask that during this message, we take the time to indeed answer that question. What is faith? We then go a little bit further and ask, why is faith important during this message? And then lastly, we ask ourselves, what can you and I do to ensure that we have faith? I've entitled this message, "Would God Find Faith in You?" Would God find faith in you? If you haven't read our booklet, You Can Have Living Faith, I'd probably encourage you to go there. You can run a quick download, or you can, at least in our local area in Atlanta, you can easily pick it up off our literature table. But I would get a hold of this book and take some time to read it. This comes from page 4. And I'll read from page 4 because the research that's quoted here is very much like the research that, if you've had a chance to read Barna or Gallup poll since, is reminiscent of exactly how people view faith today. It says this on page 4 of our booklet, You Can Have Living Faith. In 1996, pollster George Barna made this comment regarding America's Christianity. He said, "I am confident you will agree that Americans are religious people. Personally, I'm less persuaded, though, that we are truly a Christian people." Confirmation of the superficiality of faith is found in the fact that although 90% of Americans say they pray, many are unsure that their prayers actually make any difference at all. You know, I'm reminded of this use of faith, where faith kind of is a popular thing we can mention. When just a few years back, I say a few years, probably about 8 to 10 years back, I was watching an American Music Awards, and a band came out having won. They went to the stage and immediately declared, "Thank you, God," to show their faith. And then immediately after that, after declaring God being great, they had to be beeped over and over and over for their language. This whole notion of lack of faith is certainly a problem in this nation and around the world. And we have to ask, even as is noted in this booklet, are churches solving this problem? The sad part is, most of the time, the answer is no. The result of a 1990 survey of 11,122 people across 6 Christian denominations, and repeated multiple times in churches since, found that only 1/3 of adults surveyed say they have a relationship with God and are dedicated to serving their fellow man. In the United States, it's said by some to be the most Christian professing nation on earth. If this nation is having these problems, we really have to ask ourselves, what's happening with the rest of the world? Which then takes us to a verse I'm going to ask you to go with me here, to Luke 18. You know, I always wondered by background, had a sense of what was listed here in Luke 18, I always wondered what would be the conditions that precipitated this statement being made. I'm headed for Luke 18, if we will, just read in verse 8. If you remember by background, there's a beautiful parable here about a widow who is as persistent as can be. And you can see this by background about what this widow does. And you can see the parable as noted, Christ's words in red, yet because of this widow, I'm in verse 5, this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Which, believe it or not, sometimes I didn't always make a connection between that statement and the statements that then followed. Verse 6 reads, then the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge said, and shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, just like that woman did, that persistent widow, though he bears long with them. I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on earth? Now, I didn't necessarily know where this was going, but one of the things I think I've become growingly convinced of is that even though, as we've already noted here, we have a tendency to want to profess an understanding or faith in God, there isn't necessarily an underlying sincerity there. There's not a heart and mind that's connected. It's just kind of something popular to do. So when we see all of this, and granted, one of the additional things that's probably tends to impact all of us is the reality that we happen to live in a time of information deluge. We are just overwhelmed with information. I mean, there are probably, I would guess, 150 to 200 people in this room. I wouldn't be surprised if we had as many electronic devices in this room as people, if not more. And in doing so, what do we have at our fingertips? We have access to information. But what we do know is that in an abundance of information, that really nothing becomes important. When you generally are overwhelmed, when you kick into information overload, it's oftentimes difficult to focus on what is most important. And at a time in society, whether it be ours or the world, where phones, where internet-accessible devices are more numerous than the current population of this world, that's not a surprise. Because you can access anywhere. You can surf the web anywhere. So why would we spend any time looking at what's important in terms of what God offers? So then, fitting with this message, I thought it was valuable for us to ask, what then is faith? If God is desirous of coming back for a faithful people, what is faith? Well, you know where I'm headed already. Go with me to Hebrews 11. This gets really easy. You just have to sit in services almost by osmosis and say the term faith, and you have a general sense of what appears in Hebrews 11. And even as you flip there, it's probably valuable to get some sense of how faith is defined today. If you go to dictionary.com or Webster's New World Dictionary, they say about the same thing. They say that faith is devotion to or trust in somebody or something. Devotion to or trust in somebody or something, especially without logical proof. There was a song years ago, I think Bob Dylan sang it. For those who happen to be Bob Dylan fans, he used to sing, you're going to have to serve somebody. You're either going to serve the devil or you're going to serve the Lord, but one way or another, you're serving somebody. That's how this works. And even as we think through who we serve, who we're connected to, it is helpful to understand what faith means. A separate definition of faith in one dictionary actually noted belief in and devotion to God. And this is very much in line with what you and I read in Hebrews 11 and know well. I'm in Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Let me try this in the New Heart English Bible. It says, Now, faith is being confident of what we hope for, convinced of what we do not see. You know, even if you take the time to go and watch Hacksaw Ridge, what you're struck by, even as Desmond Doss goes back after each of these guys, and there are times even as he crosses paths with them, because at times there are several times when you don't even know one of those guys are alive when he passes them the first time. And they may say his name. They may be gurgling as best they can to make any sound go out. There's one instance where he comes across one guy who's convinced that he's blind. And Desmond Doss does something over and over. He always says, "I'm with you. I'm right here with you. I'm not going anywhere." And in each case, he oftentimes provides a painkiller for the guy to deal with it. But he takes his own water container and pours it on this guy's head. And the guy, thinking that he's been blind, he's able to clear, sadly, without getting too graphic, all the blood out of his eyes. And he begins to realize that he can see, that he's just been caked with so much blood from other bodies that he couldn't see. And what you're repeatedly reminded of is how Doss sees his connection with God as the driving reason why he goes and saves man after man. You know the term faith here in Hebrews 11, verse 1, if you go to the Greek, it's a funny term. It's pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S. The term simply means, and you may have it written in your comment, in your margin there, it simply means belief. Pistis means, if you go further and do further digging, firm persuasion and conviction based upon hearing. Hebrews 11, 1 then provides a reminder that God can and will do for us whatever he promises. Sometimes we can disconnect ourselves from God in that way. Sometimes we can place almost compartmentally faith over here, and we'll deal with faith for a little while, and then we'll wander in our own lives. And then, oh yeah, that's an issue of faith. I got to pull that box back over and deal with that box again. And yet what you find is those who happen to be faithful in Scripture never put that box aside. The belief they have in God is never diminished, never goes anywhere. Even as we see Doss and Hacksaw Ridge reflect a belief in God, we see him unshaken no matter what happens. Even as the Japanese officers come up to him, and there's one instance where the officers come over the top, there's a small ridge that's been blown away, and he begins to realize that one of the men that he's saving is right there beside him, and he tells the man to be quiet. And he reaches over and places another body that he knows the man's dead on top of him, because he knows he's going to be shot. And even as that Japanese officer walks by, takes a bayonet after a body, doesn't kill, of all things, Doss. And he pushes that body off, and then he turns around and grabs that guy by the nape of the neck, and he drags him all the way to the ridge, and he puts the rope around him, and he drops him down one more time. You know, Doss is unshaken no matter what took place. Doss' belief stands true no matter who's around. Those guys who are his biggest detractors, several of those guys he winds up saving. One guy that is probably his biggest enemy through basic training winds up dying right beside Doss. But shortly before he dies, he actually shares, if I were to be with any other man on this ridge, it would be you. He said, "I don't get you. I don't understand this whole thing with Sabbath and not carrying firearms. But if I had to be out here with any guy, I've misjudged you. I would be with you." Indeed, that's how we should look at God. Our belief in God should be unquestioning. And particularly, even as we anticipate and approach the spring feast, we should, too, prepare for them with a sincere, a deep belief in God. Go with me to Deuteronomy 7. We'll go to Deuteronomy 7. Verse It's helpful to be reminded that even as we should have belief in God, God extends belief toward us. He believes in us. I'm in Deuteronomy 7. There are a range of verses that are helpful to look at here. When the Lord your God brings you, here's where Moses is inspired to write to the Israelites. Speak to the Israelites, later write it down. But even as they go into the promised land, they go into war. If we remember my background, God says, I will always care for you. And we pick that up in verse 1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. He says, I don't care what comes in front of you, I will take care of them. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Those were strong words for Israel. But they were told to go forward and not waver. And if you drop down, I'll ask you to just drop to verse 9. Here's why. Here's why God says go and do this. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God, who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love Him and keep His commandments. God sets out terms of an agreement, that covenant relationship, and says, if you do your part, I will make sure that you're cared for. So what we see here, and what we oftentimes do in preparation for the spring feast, is we remind ourselves even of how God dealt with Israel, despite the fact of being in Egypt for hundreds of years. God says, nope, I'll take care of you. Don't worry. I'll do it on my timetable, not yours, but I'll take care of you. So we begin to understand what faith is, that faith is simply belief in God from Hebrews 11, verse 1. If you want to go back, let's go back to Hebrews 11. It's helpful again to ask then, why then is faith so important? Why is belief in God so important? And just a few verses later, Hebrews 11, verse 6, which is a memory verse for many of us, God makes clear why faith is so important. But without faith, and I'm reading in verse 6, Hebrews 11, verse 6, but without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. God says the only way that this works, this relationship that I have with you, is if you believe in Me and you demonstrate faith. You know, while we can't see Him, we have evidence of God all around us. This happened to be a society that so quickly dismisses God in so many different ways. It's interesting, if you go back historically, every peoples have sought to establish some higher power, oftentimes dictated by the god of this world. I think designed in each of us is a desire in order to find God, to have a relationship with God. And many of people that we deal with, agnostics, atheists, will tell you that, no, it's too much work. But the reality is that for many of them, it takes more work to deny God. You and I both know that if you just look around you, I'll just make mention of a couple of verses here, Romans 1, verses 18 through 23, to deny that everything we see by creation is not made by God takes a lot of work. Even in how we mark time, if you go to Ephesians 2, verse 12, we know that Christ coming to this earth and sacrifice is the way in which we calculate in the Gregorian Roman calendar time. And yet you can come across people, oftentimes whether it be on social media or in the media in some way, who will say, no, He didn't come, He didn't exist. And yet even as we mark time, we know it's based upon Christ coming to this earth. You know, based on how He works with us, 2, is another demonstration of God's greatness and his love and his compassion for us. I'll go to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14. As young people, we hear this verse often. Sometimes we can minimize it or we can dismiss it. But the reality is what God does is even as he works with a parent or both parents, God works with you. I'm over in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14. Remember the wording that shows up here? For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. There was an individual a few years ago that I had the privilege of baptizing, and his wife knew nothing about what he'd gone through in terms of baptismal counseling. She'd only attended once or twice. And I noticed even when we were there going through this process and of baptism, because we'd already gone through a counseling, we couldn't find a place of all things for him to be baptized. And if you know Atlanta, Georgia at all, our traffic is a mess. We'll leave it at that. But there's a spot roughly where we meet for services where 285 runs around the city and 75 as an artery goes up north. There's a spot that's below the crossing of 285 and 75 there, not far from what happens to be Atlanta Braves Stadium now, where there's a park. And so I told Tommy, Tommy, why don't you come with me? And we're going to go down to this park, and we're going to work our way down. It's not the Chattahoochee, but we're going to work our way down here. We're going to find a spot deep enough, and we're going to wait until enough people, until we don't see anyone coming or going, and we're going into that water, and I'm going to baptize you. And he said, okay, I'm with you. Now, this was about January, if I could recall, so that water was brutally cold. And of all things, his wife came with us. She followed with us. I think she was curious what in the world was about to happen. And so we made our way down. It was an early Sunday morning. It must have been about 8:30 a.m. And we watched some runners go by, bikers go by. And there was this longer pause. Now, I had said to Tommy, even when we were at the cars, I'm going to ask you to pray, and I'm going to pray that we have a long enough period of time to baptize you. And he said, I'm with you. And so we both paused momentarily, and then we started walking. And we found this spot where the water was rushing fast enough, this little kind of alcove, little area, that I thought, that's about the closest we're going to get to anything here. And so we waited, no one coming. I said to Tommy, you ready to do this? Yep. And I said, you're going all the way under. I'm not. And he said, okay. So I went into about just above waist deep. Water was brutally cold. I thought, wow, this was not a good idea, but we're here. And I said to Tommy, and his hair, I don't know if you know Tommy at all, Tommy's hair stands straight up already. And I thought, that haircut is fitting. Because he's going to be brutally cold when he gets in here. So we both waded in right up above our right above our belly buttons. And I said, are you ready? He said, yeah. So we went through that baptismal ceremony, and I said, I have to find a way to put you in. Now, what I didn't think much about is the slippery rocks and everything there. Planted my feet, and I said, and Tara, who knows nothing, Tara probably thought we were crazy. I said, Tara, you got to watch. You got to make sure that Tommy goes all the way under. Yes. So I took Tommy, put him under after the ceremony, pulled him up. Hair was still straight up, which was funny to me. But that said, I said, Tara, was he under? Yep, he was completely under. I said, okay, go with me. So then we both pulled him out of the water, walked up. We got a chance then to talk. I got to think, I found a place there not too far away in order to ask for God's Spirit to be placed in him, for God to give him his Spirit. And then we walked back to the car, and Tara stood there and kind of looked at me. There was this skepticism she had in her face. And she said, I said, Tara, you look like you don't know what to make of this. And she said, well, I don't really understand what just happened. I know Tommy got baptized, but I'm not sure how I fit with this. And I quoted this verse. I said, whether you know it or not, God just sets you apart. And she said, what? I said, well, if you go to 1 Corinthians 7, it says that if you have a believing mate, the other mate is set aside. God's working with you. And the same thing happens to you who happen to be younger, who have family members who've been baptized. Lower into the verse, otherwise your children would be unclean. That's you. but now they are holy. God considers you holy. What we then find here is that those who happen to be that God works with, you're holy. God has set you apart, set you aside, and he cares uniquely for you. He shows a faith in you. The faithful God, the one who never wavers, extends his faith to you so that you can become part of his family. What we then find from this verse and other verses like it is that God expects those he works with to be believers. It's impossible to have a relationship if we're not faithful to him. Which then takes us to the last point that we're going to look at here in terms of, so how can we have faith? How do we walk by faith? I've got four verses. That's one, a little more than four verses. But 4 points that we'll then end with today about having faith. If you're going to have faith, I'll preview them first. We must believe in God. That's the first one. We must trust in God. The second one, we must deny the flesh. And then the third one being deny the flesh. And then the fourth one, we must be repentant. We must repent. So let's go to the first one. If you're going to have faith, how do we do this? We must believe God. There's the definition we just talked about. You know, if you go backwards, you can see in Numbers 14, the Israelites did not believe. Well, they showed signs at times of desiring to believe in God, but they were oftentimes skeptics, eventually going into captivity. We know that. But even though God manifests great miracles with them, they still did not believe. If you go forward, even during the period when Christ's ministry took place with the disciples oftentimes did not believe. Which is pretty amazing. I mean, you think to yourself, they were with Christ. What does it take? And yet you see there in John 14, which we'll read around the time or the evening of the Passover, where even Philip was skeptical. Can you show us the Father? Remember that language there? And what does Christ say? Have I been with you so long that you don't know the Father? How in the world could you not get this? And yet, we see in so many different instances God speak of those who happen to be faithful, those who believe. Genesis 12. I would be remiss not to mention the father of the faithful, Abraham. Genesis 12. How do we have faith? How do we walk by faith? We do so by believing in God. And Abram here, by background, was someone God knew he could work with. Genesis 12, verse 1 reads, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" I don't care what kind of highfalutin, big-time job you would ever want. There is nothing that could compare to what God just promised Abram right there. Because he recognized that Abram believed him no matter what. And we then see Abram's example, his actions, in verse 4. "So Abram departed as the Lord spoke to him." And you can read further, but that's all we need to know from that verse. He believed God. He was told he would have these blessings, and when told to go, he went. There was no questions. We don't get a give and take here. He went. If we're back in Hebrews 11, and I won't go back there because we just read that section, there's a beauty to Hebrews 11, verse 6. If you remember the front end of that verse, it says that God, it's only possible to be in a relationship with God if we're faithful and if we believe that he is. Remember that language that appears there? So if we're back to our numbers, we've got a whole lot of people, at least in this society, who will feign, who will tell you they have a belief in God, but in reality, they question God, which is what George Barna talked about there. For God to have someone who's faithful, we have to believe that God exists. So if we're going to be a people to have faith, a people of faith, we have to believe that God exists, and He is the one who directs and guides everything that is right and good. So if you're going to walk by faith, we must believe, first of all, God. Second, to have faith, we must trust in God. Go with me to Proverbs 3. Proverbs 3, Job, Psalms, Proverbs. That came out of my mouth, didn't it? Proverbs 3. And you remember the front of this section of Scripture here tells us, gives us a sense of who we need to place trust in. This second point, to have faith, we must trust God. It's one thing to believe that God exists. It's another thing to have trust in God. And if you're in Proverbs 3, verses 5 through 6, it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding." Verse 6, "In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your path." You know, the only way this works, this relationship, this faith-based relationship with God, is not only do we believe that He exists, but that we trust in Him. So I have no idea how many of you have ever played this game. From time to time, I'll teach a personal and interpersonal class at Kennesaw State University. We play a trust game. I'm sure you sometimes athletes will play this game for coaches. And they'll put like one person and another person. And the person, if you've ever done this, the one person will turn his back or her back. And then you'll say, "Put your arms out and just drop. Fall back into my arms." Have we played this game before? The trust game? And what generally is our very first response here? "I'm not sure this dude's going to catch me. I'm not sure that female is big enough to catch me." We played this when I was going through school at the University of Oklahoma. And I remember I had a small female behind me. And the first thing I thought was, "Really? I'm going to squish her. There is no way this works." And yet, whenever we deal with God, there's a beauty to that relationship where we can turn and raise our arms and fall back and know that every time God will catch you. Every time God will catch you. Doss was convinced of that. Doss was convinced that no matter what he went through at Hacksaw Ridge, that God would be there with him, that God would protect him. And we see this play out even as he talks through. And it was amazing how resolute he was even as he approached some of these guys. At times, there would be Japanese who are approaching. One individual, he came and the guy could only mutter lightly under his breath, "Doss, I need some help." And Doss says, "You have to trust me." And the guy could barely talk. And Doss does something completely unconventional. He takes dirt and he covers the guy completely. You only see his eye sticking out. And he says, "Do you trust me?" And the guy says, "Yes." And he covers him completely. And then Doss throws himself over near another body to look like he's dead. And the soldiers come through. They comb that whole area. And then they move on. And Doss turns back around and uncovers this guy, that one eye. He uncovers this guy completely, grabs a nap his neck, and he pulls him to safety. Most people, I hate to tell you this, and I've had this discussion with both my kids lately, human beings will disappoint you over and over. Even when we have the best of intentions, our stronger relationships are those where we can trust in others and know they will be there. And know that if there's some failing, if something doesn't work, that it wasn't due to the intent in their heart. The beauty with God is God never fails us. Now, He may not work out things the way you think they should be worked out, but He does so for your good and for mine. In God's case, there can be complete trust. You know, I want to take you back to, let's go to 1 Samuel 17. When I think about those who trusted in God, few hold a candle to what David did. And if you go to 1 Samuel 17, we're going to read here briefly. 1 Samuel 17, remember my background here? If you don't, you'll remember soon. David was this, it's not fair to call him a runt. He was a smaller guy of the crew by background. And he was sent to deal with he was sent to bring supplies, food, to his brothers who happened to be there fighting the Philistines. And I'm going to pick up the story. We don't have to read the whole story. You'll remember what happens. His dad gave him food. Go find your brothers. He shows up in camp. He's watching all this play out. You get a sense here that it was, my words, modern-day vernacular. He was slapping high fives and chest butts and everything else. Hey, I made it there, looking at everyone. And then out watched some guy who would make Shaquille O'Neal look like a small dude. And by the name of Goliath. And Goliath steps out there and does the monologue. You know, come out here and I'll take you down. And we pick that story up, if you will, in verse 23. Then he talked with them, and there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, that one man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king, will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give him his father's house exemption in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." So, in essence, that which we read in verse 25. Now, Eliab, his oldest brother, this would be David, brother heard when he spoke this to the man, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come here? And with whom have you left the house, left those few sheep in the wilderness?" That funny? He probably even minimized that. You get a sense, you know, what they're like, three sheep? You left those and you came out here just to bug us. "I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause? I haven't done anything to hurt you." Then he turned from him toward another and the same thing, and these people answered him as the first ones did. And when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for them. And David said, "Let no man's heart fall because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And he had to probably guess. They thought to him, "What is this guy saying? He's not even that big of a guy. What are we dealing with here?" Verse 33, and Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight for him, for you are not but a youth." You're a guy. By estimate, 17, 18. I mean, we have plenty of 17, 18-year-olds in here. They thought, there's just no way. "And he a man of war from his youth." And David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep." So he's gonna do a little oral resume here by background. "And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it." Now, we just kind of read those words. And I think sometimes we can miss that was a real lion. We're not talking stuffed animal here. A real lion and a real bear. He took them both down. "And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant was killed. Your servant has killed both the lion and bear, and the uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. He has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." Talk about unwavering trust. "And Saul said to David, 'Go, and the Lord be with you.'" And you can read the rest of the account. We wind up knowing what happens there. God certainly moves David, based upon his trust in God, to take down that Philistine. Again, we're reminded that with God, nothing is too difficult. And so if we are to be people of faith, we must trust in God. Trust that we see reflected here by David. Trust that we see from others who happen to be those named of God. So let's go to a third point. We've already noted, how do we walk by faith? We must believe God. We must trust in God. We must also additionally deny the flesh. Go with me, if you will, to Romans 7. We'll go to Romans 7. So God has conditions here. Whenever God works with us, he expects certain things. If you are in a relationship with no rules, that is not a relationship. If things weren't made explicit, let's say you went into a relationship, let's make this into one of our reality TV shows, because I think they've done this recently, where they have you marry someone sight unseen, you're going to be married, and then we're going to film you like for 30 days and see how this all works. That, granted, if we happen to be in a different society with prearranged marriages, it might be a different thing. In this society, this is not a good go. But what you oftentimes find out quickly is that people have different sets of rules for how things work. We have a common set where we all believe in. There should be fidelity, et cetera, et cetera. But then there are a range of additional rules that we oftentimes arrive at once we're in a relationship. The beauty of being in a relationship with God is God sets the same rules. He sets very clear rules for us. And one cornerstone of that rule, one key rule, is that we deny our flesh. I'm going to go to just one verse. I'm in Romans 7. Romans 7 makes clear that, for easier language here, that there are two selves. There's our carnal self and there's our spiritual self. And these two selves war. And we see in verse 5 how God deals with that carnal, fleshly self. For when we were flesh, the passions of sins were aroused by the law, were at work in our members to bear fruits to death. What we then find here, and you can go through here in this conflict that goes on, is God says, in essence, that you're going to fight this the rest of your life. The reality is, with Romans 3:23 and 6:23, is that we will all sin and come short of the glory of God. The key to this is that we get better incrementally over time. And that each time we fail, we pick ourselves up and we go again. I forgot whatever television show I was watching the other day, but it talked about if you fall seven times, you rise eight. And indeed, that's how God looks at this. But it also requires then that even in our relationship with God, that we begin to think through how we deal with things. You know, how many different times do we have an inclination to say something without thinking first? How many times do we let our tongue get ahead of our brain and then we wind up hurting someone? How many different times are we presented with a choice and rather than be in a good place, we take a path that takes us to a wrong choice? You well know Deuteronomy 30:19 talks about that God gives us rights and wrongs, blessings and cursings. But then at the very end of that verse, what does he say? He doesn't say, choose poorly. He says, choose life. Not death, choose life. Even as we deal with things in life, as we age, we begin to realize on a much more detailed scale that we have a responsibility of taking steps, making decisions so that we minimize those things that happen to be, that draw us away. A person of faith learns to do this. A person of faith strives to be in right situations in order to make right decisions. And in doing so, we build faith. You know, you can go to a number of different places in Scripture. I'll just mention Joseph's account. If you go back with Potiphar's wife, Genesis 39, verses 1 through 21. You can go read the account. You know this by background. But he was in working with the man of the house, the woman of the house kept saying, come lie with me. Strangely enough, I think if this story appeared today, it would be one of those movies that drew all kind of attention. And in so many instances, it would end with the two people lying together and destroying a relationship. What did Joseph do, though? Each time He fled the scene. When given an opportunity to flee fornication, he said, I will not make that choice. And by doing so, he denied the flesh. And that's right in line with what God expects of those who happen to be faithful to him. Go with me, if you will, to Romans 8. Even as God works with you, John 14, verse 17 reminds us that God works with you by his Spirit, as he did with the disciples, and we just read 1 Corinthians 7:14. So too does God, even as you once baptized, work in a mightier way with you, putting his Spirit in you. And indeed, that is as it should be. Romans 8, verse 14 reads this way, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, you want a nice reward? It's on the bottom end of this verse. These are the sons of God. If you want to be in the family of God, allow God to guide you by his word and his Spirit. And in doing so, you will be a person of faith to God. So if we're to have faith, we must, at the moment of impact, the moment of truth, make the right decision. And we get better at this over time. The last thing we have to do is recognizing that we do fail, is that we have to repent. Now let's go back. You're sitting with me, I would guess, in Romans 8. Let's go back to read a little bit more of Romans 7. Romans 7, verse 14 reads this way, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal under sin. Here's the reference that I made earlier to this warring of the flesh. And you can go through here where Paul shares the difficulty that he has. Now, Paul by background, you know, and I don't have to tell, I'm speaking to the choir here. Paul by background was one that was as convinced, as convicted as possible that he was doing right in terms of blaming, accusing, going after those in the truth, in the church, until God said on the road to Damascus, Paul, you're not doing what I need you to do. And what we get out of Paul is a 180. After blindness for 3 days, Paul says, you're right. I'm going to completely change my ways. And Paul then becomes an advocate, an instrument of God to do great things. I mean, Paul writes more in the New Testament than anyone else, what we find. And so what we find here is even as he shares this warring that happens, Paul understands what you go through. He talks about the things I don't do, that I do, the things I don't want to do, that I do. And he drops down, if you will, to verse 25, and he pins the only way out of this life accurately on the role that Christ plays in our life. I thank God through Christ Jesus our Lord. So then, with this mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. The one thing that he shares here is the reality is even as human beings, we're going to continue to fall. But our responsibility, even as we deal with these issues, whatever they might be, whatever our tendencies, our weaknesses may be, we rise again. We repent, which is why it's helpful once you're down to stay on your knees. But we rise again, and in doing so, God washes us once more, and we maintain that course of growth, which is what God desires. I'll quote 1 Corinthians 15, verse 31 says, we put our flesh to death daily. I die daily, Paul notes there. Which is why, as we approach the spring feast, God makes clear as a reminder annually that we are to examine ourselves. During these spring feasts, we get to evaluate ourselves before God and do so in a repentant manner, understanding what we did wrong and knowing that Christ's sacrifice is the only way out of this life and his life by which his life relived in us. Galatians 2:20 says, I'll go to for one, we have one more verse after this. Go to Galatians 2, verse 20. Galatians 2, verse 20. Again, Paul's writing again to a separate church. But the message is clear in regards to how we are to live our lives as people of faith. Galatians 2, verse 20 reads, and I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, But Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And even as we approach these spring feasts, this is one of the things that we're reminded of. What we then find as we've gone through these verses is that despite the fact the world really has no sense of what faith is, you do. You know what faith is. You know why it's important, and you have a clear sense of what you need to do in order to have it. You have God's truth. To a certain extent, Desmond Doss had an understanding of God's truth. Now, he didn't necessarily have it maybe in the way that you and I did, or you and I do, but the reality is that the extent to which he believed God was true and sincere, and that really carried him far, even as he dealt with the battle that he was in on May 5th, 1945. For in the movie Hacksaw Ridge, we see Private First Class Desmond Doss suffer horrible ridicule from his commanding officers, beatings at the hands of his unit. But at the same time, he shows an unwavering faith in God, a certainty that God will protect him even if he doesn't bear arms in war. We see through the movie that his beliefs never waver. On that day, Doss was able to save 75 men. 75 men at the Battle of Okinawa when the rest of his company retreated down the hill. For his service, Doss is the only conscientious objector in World War II to receive the Medal of Honor. Go with me, if you will, to one final spot, Hebrews 10. Doss showed a belief in God when everyone around him thought he was crazy. Sometimes life can feel like that, but the reality is that with an understanding of what faith is, God expects our relationship with him to be based upon faith. I'm in Hebrews 10, and if you will, read with me verses 22 to 23. This is what God expects of you and me. Let us draw near with a true heart, Hebrews 10, 22, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. You know, God gives you and me the opportunity of an unprecedented relationship with him. By doing so, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, the one who never faints or is weary, as we read in Psalms, will reward you and me with a crown of righteousness, much more than a medal of honor, if we are faithful to him. When Christ returns to this earth, we read there earlier, he asks, will he find faith? If Christ came to you, will he find the same faith in you? You and I have to answer that question. That's part of this calling. It's the blessing that we've been given as those called and chosen by God.